We've seen so many examples where our clients go, like, after going through our values mapping exercise, we've now reevaluated where we do our charitable giving, or we're giving more. Or actually, I used to shop at this particular store, but now I'm not going to do it. I didn't realize that, like, plastic was such a problem. And so it's not just like the outcome of your portfolio, it starts to become part of your process in life.
Welcome to The Regeneration Will Be Funded. I'm your host, Matthew Monahan, and in this series, we're having conversations about regenerative finance, technology, and our living planet. How can we build an economy that's in service to life? Brought to you by Ma Earth. You can find all of our conversations at maearth.com. Thanks for joining us. Today's discussion is with Johnny Mayer, co-founder of Ethic. Ethic is a really interesting asset manager that aims to make all investing sustainable investing. Johnny brings a fresh perspective to the asset management landscape, especially through a design and cultural lens. I found a lot of roads led back to Ethic at my time during New York Climate Week. They have a lot of energy and next generation finance talent. So this is definitely a group to watch. And I hope this discussion helps to give you a sense of the DNA and philosophies behind the company. Let's dive right in with Johnny Mayer. We are here today with Johnny Mayer, co-founder of Ethic. Thanks for doing this, Johnny.
Thank you. I'm excited. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So maybe we start from the top. What is Ethic?
So technically, we're an asset manager. So we build portfolios for our clients that incorporate sustainability. But I think what we do is a lot more than that. Really what we're doing is we're helping our clients, which are advisors, make sustainability part of their practice. So whilst we do the portfolio construction and trading and all of those things, we're actually helping them a lot more around tools to have conversations with clients, education, regulation. So it's like a full suite of offering that we have to do to provide to make sustainability more accessible.
Yeah, I learned about you guys when we were talking to financial advisors connected to our donor advised funds, and we were telling them our investment objectives, and they were saying, you'd be interested in Ethic. Like, they really move the needle in terms of the ethics and the integrity of the investments and the flexibility and customization. So excited to dive in. Can you maybe take us through a bit of the chronology? When did this journey start?
It's a lot of years in the making. Ethic was, we started about 8 years ago. The sort of founding piece was like one of my co-founders sent me a paper on organic finance, which was basically saying, like, what's happening in food is going to happen in finance. Like, people want to know, like, what they're eating, where it came from, what's actually in it. And people are going to want to know that about their portfolios. And for me, that was the thing that was like, oh, I can see that. And so then you're like, okay, great. Like, let's have a crack. Let's see what start pulling the thread and seeing what's there. And we started just to investigate, like, what funds are out there, who's doing this already, what data providers. And just by, like, starting to pull those threads, you started to realize, well, actually, we're looking at all these ETFs, and what they said they were doing didn't really look like they were doing that inside the ETF. And then we started looking at data providers, and we were looking at how they were doing their methodologies, and they're like, oh, that's interesting how they're rolling up different factors. And we just kept on pulling that thread to realize that, like, actually, to do this properly, you have to build it from the ground up. It's been 7 or 8 years, and what you thought would be in some instances very easy is always a lot more difficult than you think.
And it's like organic finance, social enterprise, impact investing, ESG, now regenerative finance, like
SRI.
It's socially responsible investing. Like, how, I mean, and like, it does feel like the tendency towards greenwashing, the tendency towards
the incentive structure is fundamentally make money. And so, you know, what's the nice label we could put on the top? And how do we still, you know, take whatever externalities and shortcuts that capitalism, unfortunately, is so good at in order to earn the highest return possible? Like how do we reconcile these tensions, and what are you sensing now after 7-8 years, what's happening in this field?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So there's like, really, they're all just taxonomies. And so it's just different ways of explaining what sustainability is. They're just different factors. Mm-hmm. So ESG, environmental social governance, but you could break it down into the UN SDGs. Mm-hmm. You could break it into how we do it is different issue areas. Mm-hmm. But really, it's just giving a different lens into the into your portfolio so you can actually understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so whether if you care about climate, you want to understand what are all the driving factors and what are the externalities that these companies are contributing, and do you want to either support them? Do you want to engage with them? Like, and so what we're really doing is just giving a lens in for an investor to be able to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. Once we realize what they care about, we're able to then do a portfolio construction on top of that and give them the different reporting so they can make decisions. Mm-hmm. I think the first part is just making this data available to people to be able to like look into their portfolio. Mm-hmm. For so long, we were just looking at financial reporting. People weren't really engaging with their portfolios. And so now we've got this ability to add so much different data into the portfolio so you can actually construct something that represents you. But with anything, there's always trade-offs. You can't have no impact. Mm-hmm. We're always going to have to make these trade-offs. It's just, what do you feel comfortable with, and what's your responsibility as an investor that you have to like take responsibility for? Yeah.
So what are some examples of the kind of data that we now have access to, or that you're helping to bring visibility to?
Yes. So I think this is actually one of the most exciting times that I've seen, because previously, when we started, there was only a couple of data providers. And so now there's thousands. But what's more exciting, there's actually a lot of organizations that are looking at different data that aren't your usual sort of data providers, that financial data providers. And so you're seeing like asset-based carbon mm-hmm. calculations. You're seeing like satellite imagery, like all of this data can start to be brought into the portfolio so you can make better decisions. Mm. There's still a lot, especially on the supply chain, that I think we'll see a lot of innovation in. Yeah. It's so hard to calculate supply chain data. That's kind of a little bit of the holy grail.
Yeah.
But really smart people are working on it, and from all different fields. And I think that's what's really exciting. Mm. It's then, when that data is available, how do you bring it into the portfolio, and how do you start to replay that back so someone can make decisions? And so I think like a little bit about our process is, we always knew there would be a proliferation of data and it was always going to change. And so how we sort of treat our sustainability data model is more like a little bit like an iOS update. So as we get more data, as like different variables become available, and like the research is behind it and we can stand behind it, we can sort of update our sustainability model to be actually looking at the latest data when it comes available. And then being able to replay that back and make it more interesting for someone as they can see like the data come into the portfolio.
And so are there specific types of measurements that seem to be important to people when we think beyond financial metrics? You mentioned carbon. What are some of the other?
Yeah. So what we see, and maybe it's just because of the nature of like how people have explained portfolios before, but anything that's quantitative, like people get really excited, and then anything that you can sort of turn it into something that you can understand. Mm. So environmental metrics lend themselves really well to those. But we've seen some really interesting metrics around, especially around gender and how that is at not just the executive level. So like when we started, a diverse company was one board member was female. That doesn't seem like a good proxy for a diverse company. Mm. But now we're able to measure it all the way through in terms of different management levels, employees, also policies that they have in place around maternity and paternity leave. And so we're able to actually have a much better picture of what it means to, you know, to care about diversity at a particular company. Mm-hmm. But really those metrics where they can, it's easy to understand, someone can explain it easy to their client, that seems to resonate a lot.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like the core implication or thesis here is that where we put our money matters. And, you know, having now been in the space for some time, I'm curious, like, how you feel about that? Like, because you know, sometimes I think if we get so much of this anti-ESG lobbying message, we can be like, oh, just put it in an S&P index.
Yeah.
Like, it's not worth the hassle. Is it really any different to go through all of this customization of my portfolio to try to find the companies that are more responsible or more reflective of my values? Like, it's all the same anyway. And as someone on the inside of the machinery, how do you experience this?
Yeah, so there's a number of different levels. So like the things that I get excited about is it's not just the portfolio is important and the impact that that has is really important, right? So if you're engaging with a company, voting through proxy or doing company proposals on what they should be doing, that's definitely a way for you to be able to have change. And we've seen plenty of examples of those. And even divestment, we've seen, like, especially when you have like a big sovereign fund or other investors get behind like divestment, you see company changes because they're worried about cost of capital. Mm-hmm. So at the portfolio level, we do know that there is some change. But I think what's exciting is at the investor level, because it's not just like the outcome of their portfolio, it's the process that someone goes through. So it's one, understanding your values and learning and being educated about all these different issues and the interconnectivity of those, being able to evaluate what your portfolio has done previously and then how that's contributing to whether it's like global warming in the future and understanding that. And what ends up happening is depending on you where you are in your sustainability journey, but it actually starts to bleed into other areas of your life. And so we've seen so many examples where our clients go like, after going through our values mapping exercise, we've now reevaluated where we do our charitable giving, or we're giving more, or actually I used to shop at this particular store, but now I'm not going to do it. I didn't realize that like plastic was such a problem. And so it's not just like the outcome of your portfolio, it starts to become part of your process in life. And I think we have more fulfillment when we're responsible for our actions. What I definitely saw when I, like early in my career, when I was working, I don't look like a finance person. I'm actually not a finance person. I just so happened to get into finance. But what I saw was, especially when you're working with traders, is there's so many different like steps between what they're doing and the impact that they're having. And you just lose empathy. You lose empathy, totally. You know? And so that's what's kind of happening in our world, where we've lost empathy for our, like, and we have no empathy, and we're doing actions that are hurting people, the planet, and and by making this aware and going through this process, you start to actually, like, I think, take more responsibility for your impact, yeah.
So you joked you're not a finance person. What is your background and how are you orienting in this work?
I feel like I'm a little bit like, you know, in Happy Gilmore, where he's like, he's like, oh, I'm not a golfer, I'm a hockey player. My background is engineering. I have like a career path that was, it wasn't even a path. It was just like I would find something interesting and just go for it, and I'd reach there and then I'd look around and I'd find something interesting. So it was definitely not a straight line. It's kind of been all over the place. But I studied engineering. I moved to London. I grew up in sort of a small suburb in Queensland. And so I didn't have much experience about what was out there and what you could do. And then living in a share house, I met a guy that worked at a bank, and because I had some background in programming and engineering. I was like helping him with some of his spreadsheets and creating little like Visual Basic apps. And he's like, you should get a job in a bank. And I was like, okay, how do I do that? Anyway, so ended up, was quite lucky, ended up getting into a graduate program. It was in equity derivatives because I had a math background. It was like, it sort of clicked for me, and then sort of that's how I got in. But what I ended up doing was more building like sort of software and programs within banks. So trading systems, portfolio management systems. And that's kind of how I got in. But soon was like, I've got to get out of here. So many great people work there, but just the culture of banks and the way that you build products is not really, I think, how you build good products.
Right.
It's very hierarchical. Like someone at the top is like sort of telling you what to do versus like actually understanding the problem and getting excited about the problem and sort of solutioning it the right way versus how quickly can we do this? And yes, this is what we're going to sell. It's not a lot of engagement with customers. It's like, let's build it and then they will come. And if I don't know if you've used any banking software, but it's not good.
And part of our inquiry on this interview series is around Web3, and I think in the Web3 space or crypto space, it's easy to bash the financial institutions UX, and you know, I mean, it's just terrible. You feel like, I mean, some of the experiences that you go through with our traditional banks. So how do you approach both that kind of internal cultural aspect of building ethic, and then maybe we can also get into the user experience side?
Yeah, so I mean, it's like from very early on, because I had some experience in like banking, and then I went over and did more entrepreneurial things. I kind of had this like two experiences of one in a bank, like the salespeople are the revenue generators and the builders are like are cost centers. And so, and then Silicon Valley is almost like the opposite. And so what we really wanted to do was create a culture where everyone, no matter what you're working on, has a voice and is part of the process of building and is important. And so we knew that early on. And so what we try to do is bring in all different types of people. And like, for example, our first hire was a creative director, you know, because when you're building software, it's extremely hard to explain what you're doing. And our CTO is one of the most brilliant engineers. And the work that he does is so great. So how do you really show the value of that? And one of the only ways you can do it is through design and through user experience. Like, you want that to be as flawless as the code is. And so it's like thinking about that holistically of what someone's experience is. And the other thing is, like, especially when you're early on, it's really, really hard to convince someone to invest with you when you've got zero,
you know, zero assets under management.
And especially when you're hairy. Do I trust you? And so you have to be so much better. One of the other big, like, I guess, like, this was very popular at the time. It was like, move fast and break things. You can't do that in finance. Like, you can't, you have a responsibility because you're managing someone's money. Like, there's a lot of energy that's gone into that. Yeah. It's like, it's attached to their hopes and dreams. Like, it's a very big responsibility to manage money. So you have to be so much better. And so creating a culture around, we can't be making mistakes. In terms of this, we need to like take our time and do things the right way. Getting people really excited about the problems. It's like, for example, when we started, like, sustainability wasn't like how you bring that into an investment. There was no sort of guiding for it. How you report, there was no impact reporting. And so how do you get people excited about the problem and inspire them to like go deeper and do the different research and, and really explore that versus being a, like, oh, we have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
We have to tick it off. And because when you do that, you're only going to do the minimum.
Yeah.
And so that's something I'm really proud about with the team is like they're so dedicated and find everything exciting and make it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's some of like, I think the reason why we've been able to have some success is like, it's the team. They one, love the mission and they're dedicated to solving interesting problems. Yeah.
Well, I definitely recommend anyone listening to check out the website, ethic.com. I mean, it certainly doesn't come across as a traditional finance company. And yeah, I mean, the design is beautiful. It's got really nice balance of humor, but information, and you can tell there's been a lot of thought that's been, you know, put into it. How do you go about bringing more voices and perspectives into the design process and into the organization building?
So, yeah, the first is just identifying like what you don't have at the company. You know, what skills don't you have, and where do you want to get those from, and then thinking about the different industries where people are, where they didn't know they can apply their skills to what you're working on. And so even, for example, like we try and bring a bit of levity to, it's like, you know, it's a little bit soul crushing thinking about this stuff all the time. And I also don't think people want to be like lectured about it.
Right.
You know, you want to make it interesting, you want to make it fun. And that's what really with the sort of brand, what we've tried to do. And even in our meetings, like anyone that's had a meeting with us, we try and bring a little bit of levity to it because it's like really serious and you want people to engage with it. And it is really interesting. It's fascinating when you start to pull it. So definitely thinking about what you don't have in the company and how do you bring someone in and get them excited? Like some of our team, it's the first time they've worked in finance. And so when you bring someone in, you have to do a lot of learning and development and understanding of explaining. And then also through that process, you start to realize like, you know, especially in finance, there's a lot of acronyms and there's a lot of language that's a little bit exclusive. And I think it's done on purpose. It's almost like we'll make it boring so no one comes in, or we'll make it like esoteric so we can charge more fees.
Yeah.
So what language can you use to make it more, you know, make it more inclusive so people can go, oh, actually, I didn't realize it was that easy to actually understand, you know?
You just launched, sorry to interrupt, the Ethic TV series to try to create these kind of explainer videos and bring a little levity to that type of informational delivery as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Not just talking about, so we do a lot of advisor centric content around having conversations and how it, you know, everything from our portfolio optimization and how we do multi-factor optimization and all those things, which are also interesting. But then how do you engage about the issues and make it a little bit more exciting and funny and things like that. And also for advisors to be able to share that with their clients.
Right.
Because ultimately that's what you want. And what advisors want is like, it's hard for them to get in front of their clients, you know? And so they want to have engaging content that they can share and get their clients thinking about it.
Yeah. I think about my own experience when we interviewed financial advisors for the Philanthropic Endowment. And, you know, we talked to traditional banks, we talked to some boutique firms, we talked to some impact-oriented folks. And it's kind of an overwhelming and mind-numbing process. You get all of these, you know, long documents, PDFs, slide decks, and all the fun names are just these kinds of nameless, faceless, like, I don't know the difference. And like, what am I going to do? Go research all of these different...
Some sort of dark color and then rock. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That was one takeaway was, wow, all roads lead back to BlackRock. I didn't comment on that a few times. I was like, you know, do you have something like this? No, but BlackRock has this. Do you have something that matches that? No, but you could do this fund at BlackRock. it does feel like we need fresh approaches. We need out of the box thinking. We need better design and storytelling. And I want to pull in this thread that you talked about, you know, empathy building. And can you share more about how you think about that?
Yeah. So I think similar to what I was saying before, in terms of if you think of sustainability as a checkbox, you're going to design it as a checkbox. But if you think about it as a way for you to engage with your clients, then you're going to integrate it into your process completely different. And where we've seen our clients that are doing really well with sustainability is they're actually thinking about it holistically, and they're using it as a way to actually build more relationships with their clients, because they actually can talk about the things that they really, really care about. And then how you reflect that back into your portfolio, or what the advisor's doing, is like very, very powerful. And it's, and especially as you think about not only as an individual client, but if you're managing the wealth of a family,
right,
good luck trying to engage like the next generation on a bunch of like asset allocation and short-term, long-term. Like the only thing that they're going to care about is sustainability. But I think in terms of, you know, empathy building and how you do that, it's like where we see like the advisors doing well is like when they really do care, but they don't have a lot of tools to do that with their clients outside of sort of their own, you know, soft skills that they have. And so building sort of different tools so that advisors got a framework to be able to go through this, you can start to connect and get closer to, you know, that client. Yeah.
And is that where this values mapping exercise comes in?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's the process of going through that. And then it's also some of the other things we do is we do sustainability workshops, not just for our end clients, but for advisors. And sometimes that's the first time advisors are thinking about their own values and what they care about.
Interesting.
And so you start to have the conversation, and, you know, and then, and really like what I see is advisors have a hard job. Like it's not, it used to be just about money management, but now it's so much more of like, what are your financial goals? You know, like what, like, you know, it's emotional. Like it's, what are your, managing the money's one, like, how do I do all of these financial planning and financial goals? Actually, what are all the things outside of that where I want to find purpose? Like it's a very difficult role, because a lot of the time it's much more emotional than people think. Everyone says like money shouldn't be emotional, but it is. And a financial advisor is right there on the like front line. And so something is bad going in their life, they're speaking to their financial advisor. Very interesting insight was when COVID hit, one of our clients was telling me from a financial perspective, right when COVID hit, the most exposed was her younger clients because they have more aggressive portfolios. But she only received calls from her older clients, not because it was affecting them financially, because they were worried about what was going to happen to them, because they were, you know. And so that's like a really interesting insight where it's like not just about the money, it's more about like, oh, if something's going wrong in my life, I'm going to bring that to my financial advisor. So creating tools for them to be able to have the conversations, creating frameworks, education around how to have the conversations, because they're just like, they don't want to be caught out. It's a, like, sustainability is an endless amount of like knowledge. And you don't want to be there and someone asks you a question, you don't have the answer. And that's kind of some, what I see a lot is like people don't feel ready to have the conversation because they don't want to get caught out. And that's, I mean, we can all empathize with that. It's like, it's, you know, it's really, really hard.
Yeah. So in addition to kind of the greater degree of impact measurement and reporting that's been happening, and we talked a bit about the design process and kind of the unique flair that Ethic seeks to bring into this space, like it feels like one of the unique value propositions that you're offering is also portfolio construction in a customized manner. Can you share more about that?
Yeah. So when we started looking at to the funds, like you mentioned, we started looking into those, what we realized is that you may agree with 90% of the securities in that fund, but there might be 10% that you don't agree with. And so what we realized is that we'll have to build portfolios from the ground up of, and being able to select individual, companies and securities that you can do. So during that process, what we do is we obviously have our values mapping exercise, which connects through to our sustainability model. And then that model essentially is a representation of is a representation of or rules of which companies are doing the worst in that particular issue. Mm-hmm. So for climate change, we're looking at a number of different factors, including like scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, mm-hmm. Carbon intensity, like how effective a company is, policies, do they have any policies or procedures around, have they committed to any net zero and things like that. So there's a range of different factors, but that then allows like which companies do you want to invest in and not. But it's actually a really hard problem. And what ultimately when we started to unpack it is we realized we had to build actually our whole investment management platform ourselves, mm-hmm. because it's not only about the initial portfolio, but as you go on, you may want to change what you care about. You may want to, invest more money. And so you have to be really dynamic about how you do that. And so we've built it, what we call AIM, which is our automated investment management platform, many years in the making, where we're able to manage thousands of accounts across all of our clients in a very automated way, which is basically taking risk out of the system. And so we had to build that all from scratch. Yeah.
Got it. So if I'm a client of Ethic, whether it's through my financial advisor, some sort of family office, institution, direct, I have a portfolio that you're managing the assets, and we've gone through an exercise of mapping my values, matching it to your sustainability model, and yeah. then kind of constructing a dynamic portfolio of the individual stocks and other asset classes as well beyond
equities?
Yeah,
so we do fixed income for some of our clients at the moment, and then we do donor advised funds as well. And then last year we launched our nature business, and we're looking into more privates as well. We've kind of been doing, we have like a big community, and we're always like introduced to interesting startups and things like that. And so one of the things we do for our clients is just, and the community is this, if we see interesting companies, we always send that through to a bunch of our advisors. But making that a little bit more accessible potentially through a fund is, we're also looking into that. Because really where we want to go is we want people to be able to create a portfolio for the future that they want to live in. And that's a range of different solutions. And those solutions aren't all available today.
Right.
And so whether or not some of the solutions we need won't return any financial return. How do you make that accessible to someone? Do you put it through a donor advised fund and making it tax benefited or through charitable giving? So we're looking at holistically that whole portfolio so someone can create something that they feel really proud of.
Yeah, because it seems like one of the big issues we have is the silos, right?
Yeah.
And certainly in the philanthropic space where 95% of the capital sits in endowments seeking a return, and then 5% of the funds go out in grants.
Yeah.
And a lot of that return seeking behavior directly negates the value of the grant making.
Yeah.
And you walk into some of these foundations and like their teams are separated church and state.
Yeah.
It's like these guys just go for the returns and these guys do the grant making. And you're like, well, this doesn't really make any sense, you know? And if we were working together in greater harmony, maybe the aggregate portfolio performance is break even or negative 2% or plus 1% or whatever, but we can construct better financial vehicles and instruments to actually conserve the Amazon rainforest and, you know, achieve the purposes and the aims of what we're trying to do, whether it's from a natural capital, social governance, and so forth. So, yeah, like how do we break down more of these silos? That, and that's just one example, obviously, of a dynamic that persists in finance.
Yeah, so I've seen that as well, and it's almost like psychotic that you would have like the whole impact of what you're trying to do being undermined by someone that has a complete different objective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that they're set up that way. I think whatever your objective is, you're always going to optimize for that. And so I think, as we start to bring to light, like these different issues, like you can't be separate and how do you combine? I mean, we see this in, like, I dare say it's probably why we've had such destruction in nature is we think that we're separate from nature. You know, we don't think, and because most people are sitting behind a desk for 9 or 10 hours, they're living in a city, they don't have that connection through to nature. Mm-hmm. But whenever we try to separate these two things, there's always like an issue. Mm-hmm. And we think that we're being smart because it's like, oh, it makes it clearer, but it doesn't. We need to like be working more integrated together to be able to get to the objective. Mm-hmm. And especially for a foundation, your objective really should be the amount of impact that you're having. Mm-hmm. You know, that should be the metrics that you're measuring. That should be the things that you're doing, whether it's looking at different communities, whether it's looking, you know, and you also see this a little bit now. One of the things I get a little bit worried about in the nature space is like this objective function for carbon. Mm-hmm. You know, just thinking about that and not thinking through biodiversity, not thinking about different communities, indigenous mm-hmm. Rights and things like that. You just, you know, have one metric and you do that. And I think if you scale that, it's going to cause more problems than, yeah.
Yeah. And you use this word responsibility a couple of times. And one thing I've noticed is like there's a cultural inheritance that, well, I have to be responsible. Like the money has to grow.
Yeah.
Like that's like your duty. You're somehow like, I have to make my retirement grow. I have to, you know, take my inheritance and make it grow. Like I have to pass down to the kids. And it seems like we're in this moment where the tenets of that assumption are being questioned.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you're seeing it. I've seen it like in the field. You're kind of moving from this model of preservation right. to legacy. Mm. And that's a very different model. Like as a family, what do we want our legacy to be? You know, versus how do we preserve this wealth and like keep it, you know?
Right.
And I think that where it works well is when you start engaging, like as a family, what do we want our legacy to be? What do we want to do in the world? You know, and that's a much easier conversation to have than where are we going to invest? You know, how much return are we going to get? What are we doing here? I think it's a completely different conversation. One of the things we sort of, as we create the sort of output of that values mapping is sort of a mission statement and a family mission statement. And it's like, as a family, what are the areas that we care about and how do we want to invest? And it becomes a little bit of a blueprint of how you have, a legacy. Mm. Yeah.
And part of that too, I guess, is there's this tension between the long-term investing approach, which again, one of the basic tenets is like, well, we want to invest for the long term, think long term, et cetera, and an ecological crisis that doesn't afford that type of, you know, waiting decades to make a difference. And we see this in the philanthropic space. You know, you have like the Warren Buffett model, make as much money, compound it as much yeah. over a lifetime, and then give it away at the very end versus, well, actually, money isn't the only thing that compounds.
Yeah.
Value compounds yeah. and destruction compounds. Yeah. And so, you know, what actions we take today really matters. And so, yeah, like, how are you noticing those tensions?
Yeah. There's so many like systemic things that we have built in, like retirement and things like that, you know, that you're sort of fighting against, you know, like, oh, it's okay to be doing a job that you don't love and then you make the money and then you'll retire and be happy. But
right.
More integrating like what we're doing today with like our future, I think is, you know, but there's a lot of these systems and even like our financial planning tools and things like that, they're all built like that. I think as we start to question more about, there's sort of a short-term approach and then longer-term. Like short-term approach is how do you get access to capital, like investment capital that is okay, like whether it's getting a tax benefit and then you can get access to that and then deploy it quickly. So how do you be creative in coming up with solutions of finding new investment capital, I think is one approach. And then I think, I mean, this is a long philosophical question that we could probably have hours on, is like, how do we change our relationship with nature, our work, and find purpose in what we're doing. So we're not thinking about like this world where like I have to like have all of this money so I can retire versus like how do I actually do good with it now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have an answer, but it's like I think there's a lot of systems in place at the moment, and I think as more people become aware that that's not healthy,
mm-hmm.
I think you will see more change.
I'm curious how your relationship to money has evolved and changed over this time.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like I grew up, I grew up really wealthy. Like both my parents adored me and had so much love in their house. We just didn't have much money, you know? And so I think it was like I've had a very interesting kind of living on two sides of the tracks. One, like kind of growing up, mum working, a few different jobs, seeing how hard she had to work, and then going into finance and then seeing like this decadence and disrespect for money. It was like it was very, very hard to sort of reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to work so hard and is grinding and, you know, just to put food on the table, and then people are living this whole different thing. And that's still something like I struggle with a little bit.
Totally.
But then seeing like people's, like the way that you think about money or how their interaction with money, like one of the craziest things is just there's so much of it out there. Like we meet a lot of different families and things like that, and the wealth is just crazy. Some of the things that are exciting where you see people go, no, like this is my time to give back and I want to have the most amount of impact with that and I'm dedicated to it, and they put really good teams on it.
Mm.
And then other people are like, I just don't want to engage with it. Yeah. But it's definitely been an interesting way. I don't try and engage with like money too much. Like I just try and do my thing.
You do enough of it all day.
Yeah. Like it's important that you're responsible with it, you know. Mm-hmm. And just on my side, it's like, how can I have more impact in the world? How can I, invest in different projects that I'm interested in, and support different projects that I think are, which is like very cool. Yeah.
Mm. And so if you had $1 million surplus to your needs and someone just like, okay, how would you go about the practical process of deploying that to have as much impact given everything that you've learned?
So I think there's a few different or like ways to evaluate it. And I think it's like you have to even break it down by risk.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think, like if I was going to deploy capital for like $1 million to get the most out of it, I definitely think it needs to go into nature. And I think it needs to go into creating a structure where you can scale different funding into different bioregions, biocultures, like, and creating a framework to get more people interested into investing in biodiversity.
Mm.
To me, like, that's our number one thing that we have to do. Climate's obviously really important, but the wave behind that, which is much bigger, is biodiversity. And so I think, as you mentioned, like, we don't have much time. You know, it's really, and so like I would risk it all, I'd risk it all into investing into nature, 'cause I think that's most important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned bioregion, like, and we had a conversation yesterday with Caitlin from Open Future Coalition, and we were remarking that, there is no option in, you know, the 401k account to say like my local bioregion or my local community development fund. But we need that type of, easy access to manage our funds in our local contexts. And so, yeah, like how is the piping and the infrastructure looking for that type of expression?
Yeah. I think that would be the most exciting thing, where we can invest in a range of different, you know, even just thinking about what is investment, You know, like where did it come from? Why did it start? And when you invest in someone, what does that mean? You know, not even from a financial perspective, but if you spend time with someone, it's because you care. You're putting something into that. And I don't think we think about our financial investments like that. We don't think, okay, I'm giving money, you know, or investing in this company. What are you going to do with that? And does that reflect my values?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, especially as we get more local, you know, you obviously have municipal bonds and where you can invest in sort of local projects, but how do you get sort of hyper local to invest in? Yep. You know, how cool would it be to go, I'm investing in this basketball court for the local, and then you walk past it and see like the kids playing on it, or I'm investing in this particular bit of nature because I have a relationship with it, you know, I care about it. And then when you know, I think that sort of investing is definitely where it's going. We're a little ways away from that, even on the muni side. Like, it's quite hard to invest into specific projects. You know, it's only usually available to, you know, a certain set of people.
Yeah.
But that's definitely where it's going. You know, and we've seen, you know, you've seen some, I guess, evolutions of this in different, supporting different projects like Kickstarter and some of these other companies were all about like sort of supporting local people, which I think is like, has been really cool. And seeing that from a nature's perspective would be super cool.
Anything around crypto or Web3?
No, I think it's really interesting. I think in crypto, like it's, I think the philosophy behind it is really interesting. The application of it has been less interesting in terms of like, you know, a lot of people have been using it as a way, you know, as basically gambling. But I think the core tenets of it, what it is and what it can do, is extremely powerful. And I'm excited to see some of the different applications on that. I think with any creating new market, you have to experience this where, you know, everyone is on board and then it goes down and then you're going to find the real people that will actually create the value out of it.
Yeah.
It's like any new market.
Just like early internet days. So getting back to the nature conversation, I mean, I guess, you know, a lot of folks, and I think an increasing number, would probably, you know, look at this conversation and have the objection that like, it's still too incremental, you know, like we can't just, you know, fiddle with the tenets of capitalism, that we really need an overhaul more structurally in order to survive on this planet and to have a livable habitat. And yeah, what would you say to that?
I definitely agree that like some of the fundamentals of capitalism, even capitalism is not reflected in the same way as what it is, you know, like we have, you know, it's not a free market.
Right.
You know, when you have things like lobbying and especially here with the political system of it being very influenced by corporate America, you don't really even have true capitalism.
Right.
I definitely agree that it needs to be a huge amount of change, but those things are like, you know, are we going to have a revolution? You know, those are those big, big things. I think, from my perspective, is I don't want to wait for that, and I want to do as much as I can. And sometimes that's incremental, and sometimes you can slowly build up to something much bigger. And that's kind of like, you know, my philosophy is like, yeah, we do need to change things in a huge way, but how can we just keep building and get momentum? And the more people that think about the world and the impact in it will eventually get us to make some big change.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I guess the one concern I have is that so much of what I've seen in the impact investing space and the philanthropic space risks this kind of delusional thinking that, oh, you know, the system's wrong, but I'm doing a good job, you know, like pat myself in the back because I'm green, I'm clean, I'm whatever. And how do we ensure that there's like truth telling behind all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see an interesting bunch of characters in the impact space. Mm-hmm. So we actually haven't really like got into a lot of the impact community and things like that. We've tried to make it more mainstream and bring the conversation to people that actually haven't engaged with it before. It can be a little bit of, you know, like with anything, when it's everyone has the same philosophy, it's like a little bit of an echo chamber. Mm-hmm. We sort of tried to break that a little bit and go to more traditional places and bring the conversation outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big thing is it's not about making someone feel bad for what what they've done. Mm-hmm. One of the things we learned early on is when you're flagging someone's portfolio, like, you know, they may have been invested for years and years, and then you're flagging it for all of these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. An advisor's not going to look great if you're flagging it like that. And so how do you position that to be actually a powerful conversation for the advisor versus like shaming or making them feel like they did something wrong? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a much, it's like having real conversations, understanding impact, and not being like caught in like, we're doing the best thing. We all have a lot further to go, and we have to gauge with people that may not have our same views.
Mm-hmm.
But by doing that, you get access to, you know, to be in relationship with someone and to be able to actually affect change at a much bigger scale.
Mm. Are there other topics or things I didn't ask that you'd like to share?
I think one of the things that we spoke about a little bit, but I think around this is like, especially in this space, how do you, everything's design. That's to me, like everything's designed. Like, so as we think about portfolios and as we think about projects or different areas, like how do you bring in the best designers? I think everyone comes with their own sort of lens of how to solve a problem. And there's a lot of people that don't have a seat at the table, especially at design. And so how do you bring that intelligence from like outside the margins in so we can bring in the best designers and the most creative people to be solving these problems? I think in particular, like as we think about nature and we think about even creating financial products, like how do we bring indigenous knowledge systems into the design of those products? And bring that like really to the head of the design. So you're building something like together versus like, hey, I've built this thing now, just sign off on it. You know, especially the greatest designers within nature and the biggest stewards and custodians are Indigenous people. Their patterns, they still live with the patterns of nature. They understand it. Languages are still very much connected to nature. And so, how do you bring them into the design process? And so I think about different areas around that. Of bringing like different points of view into design.
Mm. Well, I'm excited to have a golfer in this wacky field of finance. If someone wants to engage with Ethic and start a conversation, how do they go about that?
So you can go to ethic.com and reach out through there. Or I'm on LinkedIn, Johnny Mayer, M-A-I-R. But really excited. Thank you very much for having me. You're doing such great work.
Awesome. Thanks, yeah. Johnny. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Johnny Mayer. You can learn more by going to ethic.com. I know they're working on a nature fund right now, so we'll be keeping an eye on those developments and bringing you more conversations like this one at maearth.com. This series is called The Regeneration Will Be Funded, because we need to change our economy to be in harmony with life on this planet. Please like, share, subscribe, let us know what you think, join our community Discord. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on the next one. Thank you.